There seems to be a certain set of buyers, though, that they have found a way to exploit the system in that way. And that's the business model. And occasionally they will buy a deal. So you will see them in the property records. So you're like, okay, they're legit. But then you get into bed with them in a transaction and it's like, oh my God, this is terrible. What are we doing? So I don't know. We've had a couple of those. And so when we see them in our CRM system, it's like, do not call this person. I will disown you if you call.
All right, we got Stash Gelazinski on the podcast today. So you've created Needle. You guys are a data platform for predicting commercial real estate transactions essentially before they trade, and empowering brokers to kind of figure out where the deal flow is going to be instead of, you know, looking back in the rearview mirror from your CRM data. You're kind of looking forward through the windshield at where the market's going to go. So, happy to have you on the pod today. Did I miss any key points in the intro there of what what Needle does?
No, I think you covered it. I think we're good. Have a wonderful day.
Yeah, cool.
So I'm, I guess professional career has been mostly made up in the world of commercial real estate brokerage. I specialize in multifamily investment properties. And what I found in doing that is that, so the way that it works now, and it's funny, I was just on a podcast with a friend of mine who I got started with, and he's off doing tech and all these other things now. But, you know, when we first got started, it was, you literally had to make 150 calls a day to break in and get any traction. And that was kind of like a rite of passage. And so it's like, okay, like, you know, what you do is you establish a farm, which is about 1,000 properties or 1,000 contacts rather. And you, in doing those 150 calls, you figure out which ones you need to be talking to regularly, which ones you can talk to maybe quarterly or semi-annually, and some that you maybe touch on once a year. With the hopes that when they are ready to sell, that you are top of mind. The calling is the first part of it. And then you ideally you have a whole marketing program that backs that up too. But what I found was that there'd be certain owners, big and small. There wasn't like a unifying characteristic. It's just the nature of people. Like if I were to call you and say, hey, Brian, you've got 20 properties. Are you interested in selling any of them? Your knee jerk reaction is no, I'm not. It's just kind of a natural thing, right? But what I found is that if you call somebody and say, hey, Brian, I'm calling about timber trails. I've got a client who's interested in, buying it or, whatever the pitch is that you decide to use. You're much more likely to have a conversation about that property. And so the quandary though was, okay, like I could pick a property at random, but how am I going to know that the one I'm picking is the right one? And so I was using a CRM system. It was great, but it only, like you mentioned, it only looked in the rear view. And there's all this data out there and it's like, there are telltale signs of properties, that when an owner is prepping them for sale, you'll see in the data, you'll see in the financial data. So the thought was, what if we could use data and analytics to help predict transactions before they occur? And so that was the hypothesis that we went to solve and set out and see if we could in fact do that. I have a friend who's now my business partner who had come to me and had this elaborate pitch deck of how he wanted to buy value add properties and was going to do all this stuff. And I was like, that's great. But you and everybody else, it's not an original hypothesis. Like, but what about this? And the caveat was my partners and I have a background in software. Well, it turns out that he's a senior vice president in charge of data and analytics, and he builds solutions like this in his day job. So we set out, and his, I'll say, magical power is that he can take my thought and idea and then break that down and articulate it to our data engineers and our data scientists and say, okay, this is what he wants. This is how we're going to go do it. And it's amazing because he speaks both languages, and I only speak real estate. I speak real estate and sales. So we're a great complementary force to one another. And when we first got started, it was like, okay, well, let's build some algorithms, proprietary algorithms, models, and they would spit out like an Excel sheet for me, that had 20 or 30 leads on it. And I would go through and call through, look through what have you. And like 7 or 8 of them would be in play. Like I had it listed, a competitor had it listed. We were lining it up for sale. Like, it's like, oh, we're definitely onto something. And this happened multiple times in a row. So it's like, okay, we're definitely onto something. So then we went and built a platform. So we've got, you know, an MVP, a minimum viable product, up and running. And I've enlisted my friends and contacts, you know, that I've built over my career to help test it. And, you know, we're in the process of you know, ironing out the data so that we can go and start to monetize it.
Nice. So yeah. So basically you did this MVP, and then, you know, you were still kind of on the broker side of the world at that point, and just basically kind of talk to them, you know, with your normal broker pitch and all these, you know, interesting enough percentage of these property owners were all, you know, either already listed or about to list. Is that kind of how it played out?
Yeah. So like there was one I remember very specifically. It's 228 units. It's on the north side of Cincinnati. It's in Fairfield, and it's called Pinnacle on Pleasant. And we ranked it as hot in our ranking, and I think we had just signed a listing agreement on it. So that was case in point right there. And then I went through and I was like, oh, that's listed by my competitor. We're valuing this one right now for a prospective listing. And then the other ones I would call through and, you know, I appreciate the call, but we're just not doing anything, which is just part of the gig, part of the deal. But, you know, it eliminated the frustration that I felt of, you know, what would happen and what does happen in making 150 calls is you call somebody and, no, we're not doing anything right now. And then all of a sudden you see a listing pop up with a competitor, or you see a comp come through in the comp services. And it's like, I just talked to them. Like, what, why did I not have the magic words to speak with them? And so this at least gives you a comfortable lead in. And it's interesting. I've been giving demos to brokers and lenders and property owners. And I did one with a group out of Indianapolis. And I was like, well, let's see what you guys have that's ranked. And they had two properties. And they're like, well, you know, we're not actually interested in selling those, but we just recapitalized this one. And we're about 2 weeks away from a recap on the other one. So, you know, it was a capital event. Not necessarily a true sale, but they did swap out the equity. So, you know, I count that as an accurate win in my book. So it just helps you. Our goal with what we're trying to do is not be an additional expense load on the brokerage community or the property acquisition side of things, but to be really a resource and maybe even allow you to replace one of these other services that you're subscribing to, because data is expensive. And if we can help supplement what you've got and then help you go out and find new deals, we feel like that's a win-win.
Awesome. Yeah. And are most of the other services just, you know, historical transaction data, or is there other companies that are doing what you're doing with this predictive data analytics on real estate, you know, transactions?
You know, there's one predominant large player in the market. I'll leave them unnamed. They know who they are. And I would call them, you know, they do have some analysis of data that they do, but it's really just more for PDF reports that they put out. And they'll showcase, they're almost more like an encyclopedia of commercial real estate and of real estate. Actually, they've just launched a new single family home platform. But there's little to nothing from them in particular, as well as some of their competitors, that offers forward looking, hey, here's where you should go and spend your time. And that's what we're doing. And we've tried to make it as simple as possible. We've made it very user-friendly. You know, there's some other companies out there that purport to have predictive analytics around real estate transactions, but I've tested one or two of them, and it really is, it's confusing. I consider myself reasonably tech savvy, but it's like, I don't get how to run your model or platform to be able to get the leads that I need to go out and then do my job. So we're trying to make it as easy as possible to use and then iterate from there, starting with the brokerage community, because it's like, you know, go with what you know. Hoping to get, you know, and then the thought with that is, well, let's go after the guys that are, you don't want to go after the market leaders. You want to go after the ones that are trying to get to that number one position. And hey, do you want an edge on your competition? Of course you do. Everybody does. And positioning it to them in that way.
Nice. So, what's like, I'm curious, like, what's the window of time from when, you know, somebody kind of decides they start doing some of these things that show up in the data signals to when they're actually listed? Like, how big is that window that you have to basically identify and then pass that as a data point to one of your broker partners?
Yeah. So, I mean, the things that we're keying on are rental rates, occupancies, the changes in those, ownership behavior patterns, loan maturities are often a dead giveaway that something's got to happen. And so, like,
the interest rate changes or something, or?
Well, no, the loan comes due, right? Like, you've got to do, when a loan matures, you've got to do one of four things. You can refinance it, you can sell it, you can pay it off, or you can give it back to the bank, depending on the situation. So there are only four potential outcomes.
Well, option four doesn't sound very good.
No, it doesn't. So, like, you know, you can see that from when the loan is cast, right? So you know that that's coming. If it's a 10-year deal, you know in 10 years that your loan is coming due. But the things that we're seeing are, like, the things that I noticed in helping to build the platform and educate our engineers was, you know, oftentimes you'll see the behavior pattern of a value add multifamily investor is they come in, they buy the property, they probably drop occupancy a bit because they're non-renewing leases so that they can go in and add value by upgrading the kitchens and bathrooms and maybe the unit itself, and then go and try and get a higher rental rate for that. So you're going to see occupancy go down, and then you're going to see it come up. And at the same time, you're going to see rental rates come up. Well, leases are often on, you know, anywhere from an 8 to say 14 month schedule, depending on the software that you're using. So you can start to see that trickling in month over month. And so if you start to see a trend of occupancy rates and rental rates increasing, that's a good indication that something is going to happen. It may not be that they want to sell. Maybe they want to refinance, because the other thing is that maybe they took a bridge loan going into it and they want to refinance out of that bridge loan, which is a higher interest loan, and go into permanent debt. So, you know, we see the solution as being viable for both investment sales brokers as well as commercial lenders as well.
Yeah, interesting. So how do you get these data points? Like, the rent one makes sense to me because you can just scrape that from MLS systems. But, like, how do you know? I mean, occupancy seems like a private data point. So how do you even get access to that at the data point?
Yeah, I mean, we're doing some web scraping with that as well as the rental rates. And you can kind of make some assumptions based on how many different units they have. And sometimes they'll even go so far as to tell you, hey, this is how many one bedrooms we have available at any given time.
But even if they're like doing construction, they'll still show those as available on their website or an MLS or something.
They're not going to advertise the units that are not specifically available for lease. No, but I mean, there are other sources that you can cobble that data from. So that's kind of how we're getting. Candidly, I'm not the one that makes the sausage, so I'm just the subject matter expert.
Yeah, no worries. Not trying to stump you or anything either. Just trying to, like, you know, just curious about how all this stuff works.
Yeah.
So cool. All right. So so you kind of get these data points, and then I guess you kind of like rank them, maybe like scoring.
Yeah.
Scoring different properties and.
Yeah, so we've got every single property, every single multifamily property in the United States above a certain unit threshold, and we've ranked them as hot, warm, or cold, or with no ranking, which implies that, you know, it's colder than
the entire U.S. already.
Yeah.
How many properties are in the entire U.S. commercial properties?
There's a lot. I think it's over 100,000.
Wow. Okay.
I don't remember for sure, but there's definitely a lot. So yeah, we brought in that data and just started, you know, ranking things. And that's, so right now the way it works is you go in, you log into the platform, and you see like a news feed of recent transactions. You'll see some headlines, you'll see a heat map, and then you can go to the section that has the leads in it. And that's really what I call the meat of the system, or the meat of the product. And you can disposition properties from, hey, I called them and, you know, they said they're not interested. And it's like, okay, you can kick them out of the pipeline, or you can move them forward through the pipeline. And, you know, have they sent financials yet? Are you doing a proposal on it? Is it listed? Is it available like off market? Is it under contract, or has it gone through to closing? So it's really meant to be a sales pipeline management as much as it is a lead management system as well.
Okay. And is it only for these like multifamily apartment style buildings, or is there other types of properties that you guys work with?
Yeah. So, I mean, through our data providers, we have access to everything in the US. We've trained it on multifamily because that's what I specialize in. And that's what I've done, you know, my whole career is sold multifamily buildings. And, you know, multifamily has also been kind of the bell of the ball as far as commercial real estate assets have been concerned over the past few years. So it's kind of like we're selling shovels to miners. But the plan is to move into the other verticals. So you've got office, industrial, retail, and hospitality, and then all the sub verticals underneath that.
So I'm curious about that last thing. So it seems like multifamily would be probably doing the best to stay above water in this commercial real estate market. Is that like assumption I have correct, or
Yeah. It's a broader question. Multifamily has, you know, the beauty of multifamily as compared to office, for instance, or retail, is that you can't live online. I mean, you can, but you still need a place to physically be. So, you know, that was kind of the root cause of the shift in retail. You know, I think we're over retailed in this country by millions of square feet.
Wow.
And then with office, you know, COVID really, it's funny. We as Capstone, my brokerage firm, we had teams for like a year and a half or something before COVID, but nobody used it. And then all of a sudden we had to, you know, work from home. And now it's like, oh, we have this amazing tool. Like, let's all use it now. So, you know, with multifamily, yes, it has sustained the best. But it's just the question of whether or not it's in trouble or not is really due to the financing use, because like you've started to see some headlines of deals going back to lenders, particularly in like Houston. I remember seeing a big portfolio going back, and that has to do more so with the type of debt financing that was used, and not so much the fundamentals of the property or the acquisition thesis or hypothesis that the buyer went in with.
Why does the bank, it doesn't make sense why the bank would want to take the property back unless there's just no way to come to terms on a restructuring. What's the bank going to do with the property?
Yeah, they don't. Lenders don't want to take property back. So they want to do everything they can to avoid that. But, you know, if you've got an interest rate that, say you went in with a floating rate bridge loan and you bought the deal with, I don't know, 4% interest because the 10 year was at 2 and you're 200 basis points above. What you can do is you can buy a rate cap that will cap the interest rate for a certain amount of time. But then if that burns off, and a lot of these rate caps have burned off, and a rate cap is like an insurance policy against your interest rate going up. Well, now your interest rate is at 9 and you bought the deal on very different metrics than how it's operating at today. You know, you could decide to try and restructure it, but I think what happens, and fortunately I've never been in this position, I think what happens is that it becomes like a lost cause. The buyer's like, well, I'm working for no equity, no additional equity. It's not really going to help me to continue to trudge through this deal. I'm just going to give the keys back and resolve to the fact that I've lost mine. And, you know, if they took on investors, my investors' equity in the deal, which isn't a good look. You don't want to do that. But on the flip side, if there's nothing left to be done, it's kind of like just give the keys back and move on and maybe focus on the deals that haven't busted on you.
Yeah, interesting. That's happening a lot in the industry at this point, or is it predicted to be happening more?
There's always seems to be a prediction of doom and gloom coming. What we saw last year is that there was a significant drop in transactions, and that was due mostly to the interest rates going up as quickly as they did. I'm on the phones every day talking with property owners still, as part of my brokerage hat. And, you know, nobody is going to come out and outright say, hey, I'm in trouble. I need to get rid of this as quickly as possible. There are some signs like, yeah, sure, give me a valuation. But then what we're seeing is that we're 20% off of their expectations. So they'll want 27 and we're at 22 on a good day.
You're saying like sale price, like 27 million versus 22 million.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just a really tough gap to bridge. Like in order to do that, you've got to have like a 30% rental rate increase in year one. And that's just not feasible. It's not real. You can't go in and jack up somebody's rent 30% in year one. It's not going to happen. So, you know, I think as these rate caps have burned off and will continue to burn off, and we're seeing groups maybe sucking wind a little bit, we'll see some more exits. And that's what we're hoping to help predict with Needle.
I want to take a quick break from the episode and say, if you're enjoying this content, the best way you can say thank you is to subscribe. So if you're on YouTube, hit the subscribe button and the notification bell. And if you're on one of the podcast platforms, hit the subscribe button there as well. And also share it out to your friends and colleagues. If you find this content useful and you think other people will enjoy it as well, please send it out. And back to the episode. How do you deal with, you know, just weird real estate areas like New York or San Francisco that are just kind of in their own little bubble that operate so differently than the rest of the country? Do you guys even like go into those territories, or do you just kind of focus across, you know, kind of like the bulk of the kind of standard stuff throughout the country, or how does all that work?
That's a good question. That is where, you know, my team members and my partners come into play. Like I can tell you how things work. I'm in Cincinnati, so I can tell you generally how, you know, the property markets function here throughout the Midwest, and most of the rest of the country. But, you know, each region has its own variables, like the Sun Belt or the Smile. If you think about the continental United States, that was the hot area for a long time, for 7-8 years. Everybody wanted to be
Midwest, the Sun Belt.
It'd be the Sun Belt, Florida, Texas, Arizona, California, up through the Mid-Atlantic on the eastern side. So, you know, the fundamentals of deals would function a little bit different because there is perceived and maybe actual greater upside in rental rate increases than in my markets, for instance. You know, you might be able to go in and raise somebody's rent or raise the rent on a particular unit $400 to $500. Now you probably got to do a decent amount of work to do that. You know, kitchens, baths, upgrades, you know, exterior facade. Maybe you have to do some capital improvements like roofs or if there's an elevator, things like that. But if you do those things, if you build it, they will come, so to speak. And they just, renters just kept coming. And, you know, that's exemplified in the housing gap that we see, or housing shortage that we see overall. You know, it's really expensive to buy a new home, even a starter home, no matter what the market is that you're in. Unless you want to be way out in the sticks, which that's okay. But then you're going to be 45 minutes to an hour outside of any, you know, set of conveniences. And is that practical? I don't know. Maybe. I don't think so. So how do we get into those markets? I think it starts with just looking and identifying what the patterns are. And it's like, if you look at the deals that trade, they'll tell you what. And then, so if you look at the deals that have traded and then you look on their history for the past 6 to 12 months, you can figure out what the tells are. And then you can extrapolate that forward on the rest of the properties in that market or submarket. And that's really, you know, what we're doing. So each property is going to have its own functionality or difference of operation, but the data will tell you if you know where to look.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think you guys are pretty early stage with Needle at this point. Is that right?
Yeah, we are. We are.
Have you onboarded your first set of customers yet? Or are you guys still like in R&D mode? Or
yeah, no, we've got about 100 users on the platform.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. All free trials at the moment, just because we're asking them to help us make improvements and test it, things like that. But no, we've got lots of interest. I've got calls later today and tomorrow, talking with people about it. So no, we're excited about it. And we've got some, great, you know, market participants who have said, you know, when you're ready, let me know and we'll go out and promote it. So, you know, I think that, and I'm in a revenue accelerator program, like it's going to catch fire. I feel like we're going to do well with it. So
nice. Have you guys had like that product market fit moment yet where you felt like, you know, the market's pulling the product out of you and there's just like a clear, what was the moment when you, kind of like just felt that?
So we kept it under our hat for a long time. Like we didn't start talking to people about it until like May of last year. And that was after working on it for, you know, as a side hustle for everybody after quite some time. But then you know, we joined a startup accelerator, and then we were introduced to another accelerator. Then we started going to have pitches with investors. And after one of our pitches, Maher and I think we were in a coffee shop or something, and just looked at each other, and it's like, this thing is pulling us forward, isn't it? And I was like, yeah, it definitely is. So, you know, now it's just like, it's going to happen. Like we're bringing this to market. We're getting closer every day. It's like, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. And that's just, you know, both of us are resolved to the fact that, again, to use another analogy, Rome wasn't built in a day. And you know, we're going to do it. We're going to push it out. We're going to, you know, keep fighting every battle as necessary. And really the hook, I think selling it is the easiest thing potentially. Cause it's like, Brian, do you want to know what deals are going to trade before your competitors? Of course you do. Everybody does. We have that. And I think especially as we build traction with our existing user base and get testimonials out of them, that we can then show to the market and create white papers from and test and maybe even video testimonials. Or if competitors start losing deals to our users, they're going to be like, what is going on? Why am I losing this deal? Why is so-and-so sniping this from me? Because that's... brokerage or real estate transactions are zero-sum games, you know, whereas selling a software, you can sell it to everybody, but selling a piece of property, there's only one buyer that can have it. And so, you know, that leads to competition. And then, you know, if you're hiring a broker, there's only one broker that can facilitate that sale, especially in the world of investment sales. Like there's not a lot of co-oping. I'm happy to cooperate with other brokers, but I don't share my fee. And that's really the whole point of co-oping oftentimes. So, you know, it's that competitive edge that you want to play on and advertise to and say, we know which deals are going to trade before your competitors do. You can come into our world if you like for a small fee.
Nice. How big do you think this thing can get? I mean, like how many brokers are there and you know what, I mean, even if you like what percentage of the market can you realistically capture and just how big do you think this company can get overall?
Yeah. In our underwriting assumptions, when we were doing our initial analysis, we figured we could get it to $50 million in revenue by capturing maybe 3% of the commercial real estate brokerage and acquisitions market. And that's as we spread into the other product types as well. So, you know, I don't think that we're being over rosy in our projections. And then it's just a matter of what the multiple is on your top line, on what it's actually worth and who's going to pay you for that. So,
yep. Yeah, it's awesome. So, you had some good stories from your times as a broker. I think, you were telling me about one where some company was trying to tokenize properties with crypto or something. And, you know, I think that one, had some, you know, faux pas along the way from the buyer side. And there's some other interesting stories you were telling me that might be a fun little story time.
Yeah. As I was thinking about, you know, interesting things to talk about here, I wanted to have some good stories for you. So I thought about what are some of my best stories? What are maybe some of my worst or most painful and then the most interesting. So the best one I ever did was earlier on in my career. It's probably in 2014 or 15. I had a client call me and this was still when the market was like transitioning. So like we weren't stabilized yet. You're still seeing deals get flipped pretty quickly. And he had bought this deal here in town. It was 110 units. And he bought it. I forget what he paid for it, but he's like, I want to sell it. And I was like, all right, great. So we did our analysis and we signed a listing agreement and we launched it to the market, and we had a buyer come in like that first day, and he's like, I'll pay you full price, all cash. Here it is. And it was 29 days list to close, and which is unheard of. Like, the normal deal transaction time is, okay, you've got 30 days for due diligence, and then you've got 30 days to close, and maybe you have two 15 day extensions. So it's anywhere from like 60 to 90 days. And to be able to do a deal, list signing the listing to the day it closed was 29 days. I was like, this is phenomenal. Like, I wish they are all like this. And then we went into his office, and he wasn't thrilled with us because we were also talking to that buyer about other transactions. And it's like, that's my job. Like, what are you talking about? I got the deal done for you. I exceeded pricing expectations. Like, you should be happy. So that was a fun one. And then a challenging deal I had was this was a few years on, and it was again about 100-unit deal. And I had a seller who had owned the property for many years, and he was getting towards like retirement age. And so he had a very low cost basis and very low loan basis on it. So he was able to be flexible with some of the terms that he was offering. So I had a buyer, but at the same time, he's like, this is my number. I'm not going below it. It's this number or die. And so I was very explicit with all the buyers about that. And I had somebody rise to the surface who's like, okay, I'll do that deal, but I need the seller to carry back a portion of the deal, because the loan he was going to get was maybe 75%, and he wanted to get higher leverage because he only had a certain amount of money to invest. And so we were able to negotiate. We had to structure it as though it was equity in the deal, and legally it was equity, but the buyer of the property had the obligation to make the seller whole within a certain amount of time. And so it's like, I served this buyer the deal on the platter, on a silver platter, and he was just so indignant about the whole thing. I had to like beg him. I was like, just like, please, I've gotten you everything that you wanted. Like, what more is there? And he just, you know, some people get drunk on power. And I think in retrospect, that's what was happening here. And it's like, just sign the deal. Like, just get it done with. Like, that's all you have to do. So that was a challenging one, to say the least. And we've had a number of other ones like that. We've had some instances where, and I don't understand it. I don't understand why people will do this, but they'll come in and they'll tie up a deal with never any intention of closing. And what they do is they'll say, well, sue me. And that's almost like their business model. And it's like, what? Like, why would you do that? It's just so dishonest.
What's the point? Is there some like backdoor motive to that?
Again, I haven't figured it out. There seems to be a certain set of buyers, though, that they have found a way to exploit the system in that way. And that's the business model. And occasionally they will buy a deal. So you will see them in the property records. So you're like, okay, they're legit. But then you get into bed with them in a transaction, and it's like, oh my God, this is terrible. What are we doing? So I don't know. We've had a couple of those. And so when we see them in our CRM system, it's like, do not call this person. Do not. I will disown you if you call.
What is it? They're just trying to drag it out and beat down the price or something?
Yeah. It's like, it's almost like they're trying to extort a ransom out of the seller. Well, I'll let it go if you pay me $100,000. It's like, what? No, you're supposed to be buying it from me. Are you crazy? So
yeah, that's not
thing. But the one that you mentioned at the top, so I had this beautiful asset, and I do think that there is a role for, you know, financial innovation. Though I'm not as versed in, you know, crypto or tokenization, things like that, but there is a group who was or purported to be. And they're like, hey, we're building a platform to tokenize the ownership of real estate. I was like, that's awesome. I'm going to be on the forefront of this. This is great. And so we went through the due diligence process, and we knew that it was going to be a challenging sale from the perspective of getting a lender to buy off on this idea, because usually a lender wants to know who their sponsor is, who the guarantor is. And the whole thesis behind this investment was, well, you can trade the equity just like tokens, just like, you know, Bitcoin or what have you. And all the ownership is recorded through the blockchain. It's like, okay, that's great. So, you know, we got through it and we got down to the closing date. And he's like, yeah, my lender backed out. And it's like, all right. And this was a time in the market where we were allowed some patience from the seller. Because he too had a designated strike price in mind, and it was hit it or die. And it's like, all right, well, you know, we could sell it for less, or we could take another swing on this one and see what it yields us. And so we said, all right, we'll give it one more shot. And so we basically restarted the contract to give this buyer enough time to go through and warm up some other options. And, you know, I was in regular phone, email, text conversation with this guy, and, you know, we're getting down to closing. And usually what happens when you're closing a deal is there's a flurry of emails with attachments and paperwork attached. And that was all happening. It was all going through. We got to the closing date, and he's like, oh, I'm going to be in Toronto on the day of the closing, but it's fine. I'll do everything electronically. And it's like, all right, that's not ideal, but okay, fine. And so I'm calling him. Hey, you know, the bank has wired their money. We just his need bank? You. His bank. So he had found a lender who is comfortable with the tokenization, and they had wired their money. It was like $15 million that they had put forward. And we just needed him to put up his share of the acquisition, and we would have a closing. And I couldn't get in touch with him. And I was like, what is going on? And so he ghosted me that whole day and then got back to me later. Oh, sorry. I left my phone in the Uber. Well, he functions on a MacBook, so he can iMessage me from that. Or he also has email. Like, there are a number of ways to get in touch with people. And it was just the strangest thing. So after,
what was the date for this? What time period was that around?
This was towards the end of 2020, I think. So it was a weird time with COVID and all that. And that's why we had some patience in the market, because COVID kind of stalled things out for a little bit, because everybody thought the world was going to come to an end, which it didn't. Prices actually went up.
Yeah, even, you know, I was wondering, like, maybe you caught him in a crypto bear market and then he lost all his money in Bitcoin or something. But that was a good time for crypto. So maybe.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. So what had happened, you know, and I'd never heard of this. I've heard of lenders not showing up to closings and buyers almost being delusional, thinking that the lender is going to do it and then they end up not. But I've talked with others. Nobody has ever heard of a lender showing up with their funds, but then the buyer failing to show up with their funds.
Yes. So what did you do? Just send the money back to the lender and cancel the deal?
Yeah, the escrow or the lender pulled it back through ACH, I guess, or a wire. And, you know, I think we gave him like a week, like, okay, get your money together. And then we can, you know, everybody was on the fence because everybody lives on fees, right? Lenders live on fees, brokers live on fees, sellers live on fees, you know, what have you. So we're all trying, you know, we all have a vested interest. Buyers live on fees. We all have a vested interest to get this deal done. Well, a week came and went and, you know, the relationship is no more, but it was just the strangest thing. So I don't know. I haven't kept in touch or track of him since then, but,
You were representing the buyer or the seller in that?
We usually represent both sides of the transaction. And I feel like I had done everything I could to vet this particular buyer, short of going and physically auditing his bank statements, right? Like, my bad. So, yeah, some of the good, bad, and the ugly for you. But, you know, the best deals actually are the ones where you go out, you get the purchase price, you know, you do your marketing, you have a bunch of tours, you have a competitive bidding process. And then you, once you've agreed on price and terms and the letter of intent, then you just hand it off to the attorneys and then they take it from there. And then it's almost like, well, let me know when it closes or do I have to show up for inspections? So that's fun. Part of the fun of being a real estate broker.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, let's ramp this thing down. So, just to close it out, you know, any, anything you want to, you know, plug for Needle or anything else you got going on?
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to, you know, show it to anybody who's interested. You can check it out at needle.us. That's our landing page. And if you fill out the form at the bottom, it'll come right to me and, be happy to jump on a call with you. Or if you're interested in buying or selling any multifamily properties, I can help you with that as well. So, yeah, that's what I got.
Cool. Thanks for coming on, Stash. We'll plug those links in the show notes for the listeners and good conversation here today.
Thanks, Brian. I appreciate it. Did you clear your cash flow?